This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
You ever wondered how the justice system could go completely off the rails? Well, let me introduce you to the latest chapter in the Richard Allen Delphi murder case. His defense team has just dropped a earth-scorching court filing accusing prosecutors of sitting on exculpatory evidence, including letters that could suggest someone else confessed. And if true, this isn't just a whoops, we forgot type moment. We're talking about potentially deliberate suppression of evidence that could have changed the entire outcome of Allen's trial. So what happens when prosecutors play keep away with evidence? Is this incompetence, arrogance, or a full-blown miscarriage of justice? And more importantly, what does it mean for Richard Allen's conviction? To help us break it all down, we have defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis with us. And Eric, as someone who's been, again, on both sides of the courtroom, which I love because you can give both perspectives here, how often do prosecutors accidentally forget to turn over key evidence when it's a case like this? And when does it cross the line into outright misconduct, not just we got so information, whoops, we thought we gave it to you?
Tony, it happens alarmingly often. People don't know about that, and the public doesn't always hear about it. But in so many cases, gosh, I don't know, around half the cases that I handle, it seems, there is at least some information that was supposed to be turned over to defense in fairness so that everyone can be on the same page, and it wasn't. And then in terms of, sometimes it's an accident, sometimes it's on purpose. The place where it really becomes a problem legally is when the evidence is material and exculpatory, meaning favorable to the defense.
And that's what we see, at least on the surface here with the Richard Allen trial, of some of the evidence that was not turned over, specifically what was brought to light. And this all happened before the attorneys for Richard Allen have now filed to appeal his conviction, and the Bridge Guy video has also been released. This is the filing right before that, where they really laid out everything in great detail with a lot of sarcasm. I have to say it was entertaining reading that filing. It was almost like a script. As I read it verbatim, I'm like, I could have written this. So I was impressed. But it focuses here on the possible exculpatory evidence of those Richie Davis letters that allegedly contain information, and we've seen some that do contain information about Keegan Klein, about Ron Logan, about the alleged confession. A lot of really serious accusations that, if it's just a letter, if it's made up, could mean absolutely nothing. But these things were not turned over to the defense so they could thoroughly vet and look at them and make that determination themselves. Instead, Prosecutor McClellan thought, you know what? I'm going to do everybody a favor, and I'm just going to say right now, these are bunk. Nobody needs to see them. I'm going to save everybody the time of day. Then he put another jar of LA gear into his head. What's your thoughts on exactly how this went down? Do you think it's legit that, he just forgot?
It's always difficult to get into the motivations of a prosecutor and why they did and didn't do certain things. But one thing that's paramount here is it's not the prosecutor who gets to determine, hey, this evidence is good enough for the defense or legit enough, in my opinion. And so, yeah, we'll throw him a bone and we'll give it to him. The prosecutor doesn't get to say whether this qualifies as exculpatory evidence for the defense. It is for the defense to receive the information and review it and decide whether or not to use it at their trial. A prosecutor's unilateral opinion that, hey, I don't think this stuff is legit, or I don't think it's that helpful for defense, should not matter at all in terms of the decision about whether it needs to be turned over. It does.
I find the reaction that McClellan has given as being kind of shocking, of just, yeah, I saw it, we saw it, but we didn't think it was anything. Again, knowing that's not his job to do that. I was expecting more of a whoops, we forgot, we didn't see it, or just something. Not, yep, I willingly didn't give it to you because I outright said no. Is this a Brady violation? I know that's what they're really looking at here. Where can this go? Where could this lead down the road here?
It sure smells like a Brady violation. For some people who might not know, a Brady violation is based on this Supreme Court case, Maryland versus Brady, where the prosecution did this exact same thing. They withheld exculpatory material, important information to the defense. And so the defense in bringing this kind of an argument about a Brady violation, that is a primary basis on which cases are often overturned. Convictions are often undone. And so it certainly is going in the direction of Brady. What defense is going to have to show is that it was material, meaning it was important to the case, and that it was exculpatory, meaning helpful for the defense.
The problem with all of that, though, likely a lot of this needs to be argued in front of Judge Gull. Which we know where that tends to go. So as things sit, can this go anywhere else? I mean, can a different court hear this complaint if they do file this as a Brady violation and bring this further? Or is this just going to sit in the ecosystem there of Delphi where, you know, no one can do any wrong if you're on Team Delphi?
Thankfully, there should be multiple layers of review. So even if Judge Gall looks at it and, you know, she has been, in my impression, extremely biased towards the prosecution, discounting meritorious arguments from the defense. For what reason? You know, a lot of people have speculations about that. But if she denies it, then it certainly can go to an appellate level where an appellate judge would look at it and say, hey, maybe this does look like Brady stuff. This does look like it could be helpful for the defense. It shows a potential alternative suspect.
Is this a conspiracy? Is this just small town politics? People acting too big for their britches, as I remember being told as a child, and really making dumb choices, but thinking that they have the right to do it. Maybe lack of experience, lack of reps in doing their jobs. I don't know. Where, you know, it can look like there's some real nefarious stuff going on here too, but there's a pattern of it. That's what makes it weird. It's not just like a one-off where it's like, oh, well, maybe they screwed up. It's like, oh, it seems anytime anything comes up here that could be exculpatory to Richard Allen, it's, we don't need that. Push that away. We're not going to talk about this. That's what makes this really dark and weird.
Yeah, totally. And in my experience, you know, there are some smaller, sometimes rural jurisdictions that are exceptional and they do everything by the book and they're great. And there are some that play super fast and loose. And if I do something I'm not supposed to, well, who cares? Because the judge, you know, is my neighbor for a few houses down. And, you know, I'm not saying that there is overt intentional impropriety necessarily. There might be. But they're just, like you said, they're develops this ecosystem, especially in these smaller towns and jurisdictions where people bend the rules and you all kind of know each other and folks often get away with it. But now we sort of have this spotlight, the public eye looking at this saying, hey, that doesn't seem right.
How do you lose evidence at this day and age? Look, I get it in 1988 when everything is in paper. And I mean, even then, I mean, come on. I mean, you can be organized. That doesn't seem to be that outrightly impossible, even with a lot of information. But today, so many things are digital. I mean, it's there. It's searchable. You can find this stuff. If you get the letters, unless you just don't file them and you don't turn it digital and you like literally toss them away, how do you lose them? Because there's accusations in here of some of these Richie Davis letters, not that they didn't exist, but whoops, we lost some of them. Some key ones that like talk about Keegan Klein and some of the things he was saying. That just happens to not be around. Keegan Klein, for those of you playing along at home, the child predator who was in communication with one of the girls and had plans to meet them the day they died. Nothing to see here, though. He's just a pervy child predator. We're going to get on a completely different charge later down the road. Again, how do you lose stuff? I mean, is it easy to lose stuff? Maybe I'm completely, you know, out of my lane here for saying that, but you're in this field.
Tony, the public would be aghast at how frequently this kind of evidence is lost. How frequently stuff turns up, in a detective's drawer or in a filing cabinet that people weren't looking at or whatever. And that is wholly unacceptable. Like you said, in this modern day and age, all of these law enforcement agencies need to have procedures where they receive evidence. It is stored digitally and otherwise in a secure fashion. And everyone in the case knows about it and knows what their duties and responsibilities are with respect to turning it over. These excuses that that just doesn't cut it for me.
That seems to be a lot of it. And there, if you read the error affidavit that was filed by attorneys for Richard Allen, there's so many pieces. Anything that seems to be or could be exculpatory, they had to beg for over and over and request and request and request, and maybe they got it. Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. Sometimes the answer was just the simple, we can't find it, or even worse, we accidentally destroyed it. Again, another one where it's like, you did what? How did you accidentally destroy it? I don't know if this is a pattern here in this department, but when you hear that we accidentally deleted it, like we're talking about with the DVR of the interviews with key suspects early on in the investigation, it's like the first 7 days of interviews just gone. Whoops, we recorded over it. We wanted to get the new Murder, She Wrote. Oh, wait, it's like a really old rerun, but can't get enough of that Angela. I mean, what the hell? How... When you have a pattern like this, is there no accountability? Because it seems like a pretty convenient excuse to use, and it's just kind of fully accepted of, that's what they did. It's gone. It's gone. There's nothing we can do about it. But there's no accountability for those folks who do the deleting.
Yeah, I mean, Angela Lansbury is compelled, but she is not a good reason to essentially record over or lose evidence. And I'm talking to Jessica.
If it's Keith Morrison in Dateline, I get it. But Angela, no.
I just don't think they can play dumb kind of with a straight face here. Is it so severe incompetence that something really serious should be done? Or is it something more nefarious and something really serious should be done in terms of a benefit to Richard Allen in the case? I think either way you look at it, it has to result in some kind of measure of overt fairness to Richard Allen, which has been severely lacking throughout the entire case, in my opinion.
Very much so. I mean, whether McClelland's just incompetent and really, really not detailed and bad at his job, which I guess may be the case, or this is a purposeful railroading job against Richard Allen. Either way, the effects are the same to Richard Allen. It doesn't necessarily mean what the intent was. It means anything, incompetence or ill will. Still affects him the same way. At what point can we look at McClelland and go, okay, you are not qualified to handle this case. You're not qualified to even do your job. So, I mean, is there a point where another court can look at this and go, okay, there needs to be a different prosecutor here because this person, they can't seem to handle the basics of their job. At worst, maybe there's something else happening. I mean, is there a path for something like that?
You know, regardless of how egregious some errors may have been, the entity that gets to decide which prosecutor is on a case, by and large, is the prosecutor's office.
Yeah.
And so a judge typically can't say, hey, you screwed this up royally. Your chief should be smart and put someone else on. I guess they could say that. But they can't force a new prosecutor on the case. Sometimes there are motions to disqualify, but those are usually where there's some kind of actual legal conflict as opposed to just alleged misconduct. Yeah, it's typically just a decision the prosecutor's office would have to make. If they're smart and if they're prudent and if they're fair, I think they could consider somebody else.
So give me an insight here as to where McClelland is on the prosecutor's office. It does, especially when an entity investigates itself and has to make these choices, it's not usually always the best choices that are made. So is it is there other people in this prosecutor's office that could say, hey, Nick, maybe go take a trip to Dollywood this weekend. Here's some tickets. In fact, stay there for the next year. Go have fun. It's a lovely place. Try the chicken. And we're going to get somebody else in here to do this. What is that process like if it were to be explored? And do you think there's a chance in hell it would be explored in this case?
They could, and in my impression, they should. This kind of thing happens regularly in prosecutors' offices, and including in the one where I worked, where sometimes a prosecutor is just not the best fit for a case for various reasons. It could be they screwed the case up. It could be they got too personally attached to the case. It could be that there is something in that prosecutor's background that makes them, that compromises their objectivity in terms of decision-making. And so for those reasons, prosecutors are often rotated out. There are new prosecutors that come onto cases, and especially with one that has been plagued with such allegations of misconduct, I think it'd be a smart move for the prosecutors to get somebody else on it.
We know that they are now appealing the conviction officially. Those files have just been filed. Where does it go from here with this appeal? What court does it go to? What judge is going to be seeing this? What are the next steps in the future timeline here in the case against Richard Allen?
So oftentimes there's a doctrine called exhaustion of remedies, where the defense has to go up the ladder kind of to each individual court, expressing their grievances and requesting a new trial or vacation of the conviction. Typically, that starts with Judge Gold with a motion to reconsider. We might be past that. I'm not entirely sure. Mm-hmm. But the next stage would be the appellate court. So the state appellate court there, and then the state Supreme Court, if the appellate court does not reverse the conviction. From there, there are also habeas corpus petitions that can be filed in federal court. So like I said, there are a number of layers of review, and hopefully one of them is going to get this right.
So basically, we're looking at if it's not going to Gull first, we're going to go to state. And then if they say yes, let's play out the possibilities here. They say yes, it looks like you should be able to appeal this. Is that just the state going, Gull has to go back and review this again? Or is the state able to make a call here and say, I mean, tell me what this means?
Yeah, certainly. So the appellate court at the state level that is above Judge Gold, they could review this and say, hey, look, I think there was a Brady violation, and I think a new trial is warranted. That would be the most likely remedy. A complete dismissal from an appellate court is much more rare. So if there was a new trial, then it would go down, but it would usually go back to Judge Gold, even if she was the one who made the alleged errors that the court found as grounds, or at least partial grounds, for reversal. So it goes back kind of to the drawing board. Now, it could be given to a different judge at Judge Gull's level as well.
Does that seem like insanity? I mean, you're giving it back to the same people. I mean, especially if there is violations that were like clearly, in violation of the actual defense that seemed to have some sort of malice to it, to go, okay, just try this again. Let's hope you maybe have a different opinion this time. Is this a big flaw in our system where maybe that should be a little ironed out better?
I think there are several flaws like that. Yeah. Another similar one is where a trial happens and a defendant is convicted and they believe that the judge made a bunch of errors at trial. They have to file, usually in most jurisdictions, a motion to reconsider or something. They style it differently in different places. But they have to go back to that same judge and be like, hey, we think you screwed up on X, Y, and Z. Do you agree with us? Nine times out of the 10, the judge is like, no, I was right. And so it just seems like kind of a silly exercise.
Like, follow the yellow brick road. Oh, look, it's Mr. Oz again. Oh, surprised to see you here. Okay, so that state, let's say the state says, no, we think this all worked out lovely. You go to the state Supreme Court. What's the options from there?
Totally. So state Supreme Court would be above the appellate court level, but still at the state level. And they would review it just the same. And so you get kind of another bite at the apple in that sense if your defense and the appellate court ruled against you. The state Supreme Court could absolutely impose a new trial. The state Supreme Court could dismiss the charges. Like I said, those are pretty darn rare. But if the state Supreme Court orders a new trial, well, we're going back down to the trial level, and that's likely Judge Gold.
Back to Oz! Damn it. Don't we, haven't we established all the remakes of Wizard of Oz suck? Don't do it. Okay. And let's say it fails there too at the Supreme Court level. And it seems like all roads lead back to Gull for the most part. Habeas corpus with the federal level. What happens on that one?
Yeah, those are less often granted than like a direct appeal at the state level. So it's kind of a Hail Mary. It's kind of a last ditch effort to obtain some relief for the defense. But every now and again, they are granted. The federal court disagrees with the state court's rulings and orders a new trial. Sometimes, even when a new trial is ordered, a bond is issued pending that new trial. But in this case, with two child deaths, I don't see that happen.
Is there, I know you had mentioned, like, they could, you know, on even on a state level or a state Supreme Court level, if they decide it goes back, they could say, okay, we're going to find a different judge here. But if they don't, I mean, is there any like direct path that they have to get this in a different atmosphere other than Gull World?
Yeah. So if defense got a new trial, they could file like a motion to recuse Judge Gull, essentially just arguing the grounds that, hey, Judge Gull was the reason for some of these errors and exhibited, in defense's opinion, substantial bias against the defense. And even if that motion is not meritorious, sometimes it's enough for a judge to be like, hey, I don't agree with any of this, and I don't think any of this is right, but to avoid the appearance of impropriety, I'll give it to someone else. That's a possibility too.
It's the problem is the person who decides that is Gull, right?
Yeah.
Again, hey, we're going to say all these things that we don't think are right about you. Will you admit to it? No. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, where do you think, in your opinion, after, you know, you've been watching this case with all of us for a long time now, where do you think this should go, and where do you think this will go? That may be two different questions.
I think an appellate court reviewing, a state appellate court reviewing the appeal, especially on the Brady violation argument, that has real traction, and that often results in reversals. And here, you know, in talking about whether it's important, well, it shows a potential alternative suspect for whom there is other corroborating evidence that they might be guilty. And on top of that, it should have been turned over, couldn't have been used by defense in the first drugs. They didn't have it. And so the most fair option is a retrial. And I think that there is at least a reasonable likelihood of Richard Allen prevailing on that ground, or at least I think that's his strongest ground of appeal.
But if we do get back to Gull, the admission of evidence in here, the admission of third party culprits, all of these things that were denied on failed round one, what's the incentive to allow it in this time? I mean, is there any reason to think that Gull would, if it does go back to her, that she'd be like, okay, let's let that in this round?
You know, Judge Gull, as biased as any judge could be, they also don't want to get reversed. That looks bad for them.
Yeah.
That looks bad for retention. I don't know if they're elected out there, judges out there, or if they're appointed, but it's just not a good look either way. And so, and she kind of has an out, because she could be like, hey, look, I didn't think there was enough alternative suspect in the first trial, but now with these letters, hey, I didn't know about that either. That gives me enough to meet the threshold of allowing an alternative suspect. She could kind of dance around it and let it in a way that might be self-serving, but also helpful for Richard Allen.
Do you think she'd recuse herself? I mean, she obviously, it's been brought up many, many, many times, and every time the answer is no. I don't see her doing it at any point in this, but I mean, at some point, do you just get sick of it and go, hey, you know what? Obviously, y'all got your opinions. For just the sake of this, another qualified judge can handle this. I'm going to go to Dollywood too, and I'm going to enjoy the funnel cakes for a week. You know, what could happen here?
That's the thing, is that I think the smart move for her, even if she thinks she did nothing wrong, would be to say, like you said, there's another qualified judge who can handle this just the same. And even though I don't agree with any of the allegations against me, I want to preserve the integrity of this judicial process, of this judicial district, and I want to avoid the appearance of impropriety. I'm going to hand it off. I think that would be the smart move. You know, do personal feelings get in the way of making a smart move sometimes? Sure they do.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.